And you were explaining at that time you didn't take people on with university degrees. They were 17-year-olds.
Yes, I think we were so uneducated ourselves that we were slightly suspicious of higher education. Mm. And fortunately, we had a fairly high success rate. Mm. And we took the view that it was better to be cruel fairly early on if somebody wasn't making the grade. And we would tell them at a pretty early age, at 18 or 19, we just didn't think they quite had the talent, the market mentality. Of course, in those days, we were just a trading outfit. Now we're an integrated house with whatever that may mean, but with broking angles and everything of the sort. But in those days, just a trading house. And it may have been rather hard, but at least the boys could then go on and find a job without being too far along in the world and having a thump on the nose when they thought they were on the right trail.
Now, thinking about Smiths again at this point, sometime around the mid-70s, did you feel there was anything distinctive about Smiths in comparison with other jobbing firms?
Yes, I think so. And I think I was very lucky to be involved in, as I said before, I think we had this tremendous team spirit. Everybody knew what was going on. We tried not to hide anything from anybody. Perhaps in a way we were a little bit lax in security, but we took the deliberate view that most people should know what is going on, and we trusted people to maintain security to a pretty high degree. And we didn't have much careless talk costing lives or money. And I think the degree of involvement of particularly the younger people in our firm has contributed very considerably to the success of the firm, and has even lasted right up until this moment, where we retained a hard core of a very considerable number of people who have been with us since school age. And obviously, as you go on, you know their faults, their foibles, their good humour, their bad humour, their mild idiosyncrasies, and you knock them together and make allowances for some and no allowances for others. And touch wood, it has been a tremendous team effort.
What had actually happened to the business of jobbing? Now again, thinking about the 70s, we'll start with the actual mechanics of jobbing on the floor of the stock exchange. Was it very different to when you'd started, or was it basically the same?
It was pretty much the same, but more sophisticated means of acquiring profit were being brought in all the time. There was the expert stagging of various issues, BP issues, the very, very big issues that were on offer at the time, and eventually cable and wireless, the privatisation of cable and wireless, the telecom one, what was before telecom, but whatever it was. But there was a much more sophisticated approach whereby the company and various outposts of the company stagged these issues pretty heavily, and they brought in very considerable rewards. That sort of thing didn't go on, certainly in our company, to the degree that it has done in the early days.
Could you explain briefly what was involved in, as you say, expert stagging? Perhaps with reference to a particular example?
Well, for example, one that I remember very clearly was the cable and wireless, which was, we thought, priced fairly cheaply by the government. They had to get it off, and it was quite an exciting title, cable and wireless. You were just coming into the new areas of communication and everything of the sort. And, the simple thing was that we went round to the bank and all the various banks and borrowed as much money as we humanly could to stag or apply for as many cable and wireless shares as we could possibly get. Well, in those days, if an issue was oversubscribed by a certain number of times, on most occasions you got a percentage allotment and there was no cut-off point. So if you could apply for a very considerable number of shares, and let's say you got 20% of your shares and they opened up at a premium of 30%, it was a very profitable exercise, and this was got down to an extremely fine art. Multiple applications were, I think, allowable in those days, so you could apply in various degrees and the same name for various amounts of stock, and there was a sporting chance that you would get your percentage allocation. Obviously, in time, the authorities got wise to this and very much more sophisticated, and they've now introduced rules and regulations for the new privatisations, particularly, whereby you cannot make multiples. But that was one, again, which had probably been done to a greater degree than in our own firm, either selling short of old stock and buying new stock when there was a rights issue. And as you went on and built up reserves, you could do this to a much, much greater degree for a longer period of time. And there were, due to the vagaries of the market or various individuals who had to sell on particular occasions, you would buy some very cheap stock, perhaps old ordinary stock, as against the new stock or vice versa. And we could do this on a much greater basis than we could previously in the company.
What happened to the number of jobbing firms now? Again, thinking about the development of Smith during the 60s and 70s, what was happening to other firms?
Quite a large number of the jobbing firms went out, but quite a considerable number of those people, the ordinary traders, not so much the partners, the senior partners, but the ordinary traders and perhaps junior partners, gravitated to the bigger firms, and the bigger firms became bigger and the smaller firms went under, basically, or disappeared. Wed Durlacher, the amalgamation of Wed and Durlacher, became a very, very potent force and were the leading stock exchange firm for some considerable time. Aykroyd and Smithers was another amalgamation. And of course, those two were the very big guns in the gilt market. Mm-hmm. And when the government was knocking out gilt stock by the hundreds of millions during the 70s and early 80s, they were creaming it. They had a virtual monopoly on the situation. Incidentally, we did have a very, very tiny flirtation with the gilt market, in which I was involved in, I think it was 1973, but it was no great success. I was by no way.
Explain the background to that a bit.
Yes, well, we decided that we ought to try and expand our areas of operation a tiny bit. And we looked at the gilt market because there was such a high turnover. And we heard of a little firm called R.H. Prance, who wanted to try and continue. The three partners there were all over 70. Well, they wanted to try and tick it over. And we became involved in discussions, and you had to apply to the government broker to be accepted as a gilt jobber, and you had to have a Z account at the Bank of England and go through all the formalities, and it was a totally different game. Well, we got somewhere along the line, took over R.H. Prance, and one of our partners was scheduled to go in there, David Heath, but at the last moment the senior partners had a change of heart and they asked me if I would do it. And to be blunt, I knew nothing about the gilt market and don't know a lot about it now, and thought you could sort of slightly go in there and use the methods that one uses in the equity market. Maybe exaggerating a little bit, but I'd done some homework, but I found it a little bit foreign. And we went in there, and I think we were a little bit unlucky, because, in certain respects, because the government broker changed the rules by which he was operating. He used to have various taps whereby he would supply stock on bids from the jobbers, and also he would take stock if the jobbers were in a little bit of a mess. But very, very shortly after we went in, it became a free-for-all. At the same time, I think interest rates went up very considerably, and the economy was in a bit of a mess, and we were just on the verge of the property crash at that particular time. So all in all, the thing was a little bit of a mess. added to the fact that we were very inexperienced and quite obviously didn't do it terribly well and couldn't quite understand the mechanics of how the government broker operated. And the big two had a look at everything first of all. While you were waiting on the fringes, the whole market was changing, so it was a rather difficult operation, certainly for us. And we retired hurt after a fairly short period of time. I think we were only in there for about 3.5 months and lost, I think it was about £380,000, which was a pretty considerable sum to us in those days, but which is, I won't say an insignificant amount but these days, but is several times the P&L of one book, or can be, in these days.
Now, was it at this time that you were also thinking about a merger with Bisgood?
The Bisgood merger came about in was proposed in 1977, I think. And I didn't like the idea terribly much. Without any disrespect to Bisgood, I didn't think we'd get on terribly well with them. And the idea was proposed by Tony Lewis and Ed Puxley, who was the managing director of Bisgood at the time. And we explored the possibilities, and it was going ahead. And fortunately, but somewhat ludicrously, I thought, the Monopolies Commission intervened on the most doubtful of reasons. I think there was an overlap in about 27 stocks, and this was the reason given for an investigation by the Monopolies Commission. I don't know whether the authorities had suggested the Monopolies look at it, but it really was on the flimsiest of a basis, really. However, this went on, and eventually the Monopolies Commission cleared it. And we as a company, we'd done quite a lot of work with Bisgood and looked at it, and as I said, my heart really wasn't in it. And we had our own board meeting prior to discussing the situation, and it's, I think, the only time I ever disagreed with Tony Lewis on a major issue. Normally, by that time I was deputy chairman, so normally you don't argue. The executive of a company sorts things out prior to things and then puts its recommendations, if you like, to the rest of the board. But this was a very divisive sort of issue in the company. And it's the one occasion I totally disagreed with Tony. And I said to him at the time of the board meeting, or just before the board meeting, I'm giving you a warning, Tony, that I'm going to have to disagree with you, absolutely, and I'm going to have to vote against this and give my reasons why. And in fairness, Tony said, okay. Anyway, the vote against went against merger.
Could you briefly describe the arguments for, the arguments against? Well, what were the main motives behind contemplating this merger?
I think the added size and clout that it would have given us, I think Bisgood were technically better than we were. Ed Puxley was a top-class administrator. We hadn't got a top-class administrator. They had a very able finance man by the name of Lunn, I think it was, who would possibly have come, but then I think at the last moment decided he didn't want to come in a merged outfit. I didn't like the idea because of the what I thought would be the crashing together of incompatible personalities from the trading. And I don't think that Bisgood had such a high rating in the stock exchange as we had. I don't want to be unfair to them, but I genuinely don't think they had such a high rating. I thought we were a firm on the up and up that could do it, go it alone. And we didn't need the bulk of the business contribution. One or two positive parts, quite definitely.
Yes.
But We were beginning to be a bit of a power, more than a bit of a power, in the equity market particularly. The golds were going along, although it was a little bit quieter then. We were sort of getting within striking range of Wade and Aykroyd, had equaled or overtaken Pinch and Denny, who were quite a big force then. And it just did not appeal to me in the slightest.
Well, this brings us relatively close to Big Bang, and probably the last area we could talk about. And that is, again, the jobbing system in general terms. You say you were, you felt you were on the up and up.
Mm-hmm.
Right up to the reform of the stock exchange, was the jobbing system still an efficient way of organising business?
I like to think so, yes. Yes, business was transacted in a very considerable degree. There were some faults. I mean, there are some faults in the new system. The advantages, being explained, I should think, thousands of times, are the face-to-face situation that one always had on the floor of the house, whereby business could be done very, very quickly, very efficiently, and any problems sorted out, talking as principal to principal immediately. You know exactly who you were dealing with, and should there have been any problems or misconduct or anything of the sort, it could be rectified almost immediately.
Incidentally, were you all still going down to the floor of the exchange?
Yes.
Trade, most of
most of us, although with the growth in the industry and the computerisation, back office had increased very, very considerably. It did need far greater reserves of back office organisation than several years ago. And, sorry, I was going to say, things did get more complicated as time went on.
Was there any momentum for changing the jobbing system building up from anywhere?
Well, I think the powers that be did this deal with Cecil Parkinson.
This being the Stock Exchange Council?
Big Bang, yes, council, the council, whereby we had to open up and abolish minimum commissions. Now, I've never been quite convinced myself that the abolition of minimum commissions necessitated a free-for-all, and one had to be an integrated securities house because commissions were going to be free to be negotiated. But a fairly considerable body of opinion thought they couldn't survive if there was going to be this fight on the commission line. Now, I think the gilt market particularly should take a lot of blame for this, or the gilt brokers, because they had a glory run for several years, and the major gilt broking firms were coining it hand over fist and resisted very, very strongly any moves to reduce commissions. And this, I think, got up one or two noses, maybe politically as well, and there was this pressure to change. And again, in fairness, there was the internationalisation of the various stock exchanges. Communication was so quick, virtually instant these days, that it was necessary to have some change, but whether it was necessary to go quite as far as total integrated securities houses to the degree that we have done, I personally have my doubts.
How did Smiths cope with the changes?
Well, we were the one house that made a public show of wanting to stay on the floor of the house, and we stated that if it was viable, we would stay on the floor of the house and maintain a presence on the floor of the house. By that time, we were doing virtually 30% of the equity turnover, which shows how much we had progressed, and I think it did peaked out at just under 33%, which was almost too much, because you had too much obligation on you to trade every time. You had to commit yourself to very, very large size to do that sort of business all the time. And we'd overtaken Wade and Aykroyd. And we did make a very, very strong effort to stay on the floor of the house, but within a short space of time we found it wasn't viable, and we'd made alternative arrangements to have dealing rooms upstairs where we went every night after the close of the floor of the house, so it was only a question of really coming in and dealing from the offices in the morning, as most of our competitors did.
Was it an expensive process for Smiths? Did you have to buy in a lot of new equipment?
Yes. All dealing screens, they're all expensive, and computers aren't the great money savers that everybody expects them to be. The more you computerise, the more you need expertise to manage them, mastermind them, repair them, replace them. And we, with the integration, when we took over Scott Gough Leighton, which was a small broking house in 1986, which brought in all the differences of a broking business to a jobbing business, we had to spend quite a lot of money on computers. And they had quite a big private client business, which we sold within about 18 months, I think. We just found it wasn't paying. But it does take up a lot of paperwork and machinery processing all this stuff.
Well, I'd like to ask one concluding question, and that's reviewing your own career on the stock exchange. What would you say it took to be a successful jobber?
In my case, I suppose a little bit of inborn trading talent. I was never coached in it, but I suppose I had it because I got to where I have. A bit of luck, quite a lot of luck in being in the right place at the right time. Although I sometimes think that if you have a little bit of talent, you get to the lucky spot somehow or other. I don't quite know how. I think the trust and friendship of a hell of a lot of people, really. And I don't think very much else.
Good, I think we can stop there. Thank you very much.
Thank you.